looking at the historicity of the New Testament here this evening. I'd like to begin just with a little synopsis of the life of Christ. Jesus never had a formal education. He never traveled 100 miles from his home. He only had a 3-year public ministry. And after he died, he left behind a ragtag following of untrained disciples. And yet 2,000 years later, Jesus is arguably the most influential human being that ever walked the face of the earth. He's somewhat of an oddity historically. Well, we want to study if there is good historical record for the life of Christ. We're going to be studying the subject of historicity tonight, the historicity of the New Testament. Well, we're going to break this up into 7 different T's of historicity. Number 1, truth. Number 2, time frame. Number 3, transmission. Number 4, texts. Number 5, trivial details. Number 6, testimonies. And number 7, trustworthiness of the disciples. Let's get started with that first category, that first T, truth. Historical truth. Can we even know history? Before we even get into the subject of historicity, is it possible that we can even know historical knowledge, historical truth? Or is history just in the eye of the beholder? It's whoever won the war gets to record the history. Can we even know historical knowledge? So let's look at our first objection here. Isn't history always being revised? This is the way skeptic Patrick Gardner describes it here. He says, quote, "In what sense can I be said to know an event which is in principle unobservable, having vanished behind the mysterious frontier which divides the present from the past?" So how is it that we could know something historically that isn't directly, empirically observable? Gardner writes, "And how can we be sure that anything really happened in the past at all? That the whole story is not an elaborate fiction, is untrustworthy as a dream or a work of fiction." How do we know anything happened historically? Well, that's historical skepticism on the one hand. Now we have historical revisionism on the other. Historian James McPherson writes this, quote, "There is no single eternal and immutable or unchanging truth about past events and their meaning. There's no such thing as the historical truth. That's impossible." He writes, "The unending quest of historians for understanding the past, that is revisionism, is what makes history vital and meaningful." So I hope you get his point. How is it that we could actually know historical events when history is constantly being revised? Is it not? Historians are constantly taking different angles, discovering new data about the past. Well, if history is always being revised, is it possible to even know the past at all? Well, that's the question we want to take up. Well, I think first, in response, we could say this. First, revision implies truth. Revision implies truth. So, if we're saying that we're trying to get at the truth by revising history, that implies that there is a truth to be revised. This is the way that Norman Geisler describes it in his book, Christian Apologetics. He says, "The constant rewriting of history is based on the assumption that objectivity is possible. Why strive for accuracy unless it is believed that the revision is more objectively true than the previous view?" I hope you see his point. Why revise unless we're moving toward an absolute or objective goal? Geisler writes, "Why critically analyze unless improvement toward a more accurate view is the assumed goal?" So revision actually implies truth, not falsehood. Secondly, this objection is a false dilemma. A false dilemma, or sometimes it's called a false dichotomy. This objection implies that either we have 100% perfect understanding of historical events in the past, or we have no understanding of past historical events. Either we have perfect 100% understanding of all history, or we have no understanding at all. Well, we're not claiming that we have 100% perfect understanding of historical events. What did Napoleon do January 1st, 1801, at 12 o'clock p.m.? I don't have the first clue. Maybe he spit on the floor. Maybe he kicked one of his officers in the face. I have no idea. We don't have 100% perfect understanding. But just because we don't know it perfectly doesn't mean that we are unable to know it accurately. Or to put that another way, just because we don't know history fully, that is not to say that we cannot know it truly. We can have true knowledge even though we don't have perfect knowledge. Think about it like this. No field of knowledge, no field of study has perfect knowledge, perfect understanding. You know, think about it like this. You take your car into the mechanic because the transmission is slipping. Does your car mechanic have perfect 100% understanding of transmissions in cars? Well, no. No car mechanic has a perfect 100% knowledge of car transmissions. Does that mean he doesn't know how to fix your car? Well, no, of course not. What about Stephen Hawking? Does Stephen Hawking have 100% perfect knowledge of astrophysics? Well, no, of course not. Does that mean that he has no knowledge of astrophysics? Well, of course he does. Otherwise, he wouldn't be publishing books. Thirdly, we can point out, when we get into the subject of historicity and historical study, what we're claiming is that we can know the core facts. We can know the core facts, and those are going to stay relatively stable. They're not going to budge all that much. The core facts of history don't budge all that much. However, the interpretation of the facts often changes. The core facts stay the same, but the interpretation of the facts often change. So, let's think about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth came in and shot Abraham Lincoln. Now, the historical revisionist will publish a new book trying to interpret why John Wilkes Booth shot Lincoln. It may have been because of slavery. It may have been because of abolition. It may have been because John Wilkes Booth was crazy. It may have been because Booth had issues with his mother. They don't know. Everyone has a different interpretation as to why Booth did that. But no one would deny that Booth shot Lincoln. You know, you'd never have a historical revisionist who said that it wasn't Booth who shot Lincoln, it was Lincoln who shot Booth. No. The core facts stay the same. Now, they might give a different interpretation as to why that happened. You know, every year we have encyclopedias printed, and there's not much difference between the facts that are represented in the encyclopedias. Small details change as things are brought to the surface. However, the core facts typically stay the same in history. To put that another way, the commentary on these events might change, but the content doesn't change all that much. And that's what we're arguing. Fourth, without a belief in historical truth, historical statements become absurd. I don't know how you feel when you bump into someone who denies the Holocaust ever occurring. I'm pretty sure how I feel. It makes my blood boil when anti-Semitic people talk about how the Holocaust is just a big Jewish hoax, never happened. You know, we have more historical data on that event than any other event in human history. We have pictures. We have video testimony. Remember years ago when Spielberg was going through and recording people who had survived the Holocaust? I thought, why would he do that? You know, as though somebody would deny the Holocaust. When people deny that, it makes my blood boil. But if this worldview is true, if historical skepticism is true, then we would have no basis upon which to say the Holocaust happened or didn't happen. Under this view, a historical novel would be no different than a historical textbook. No difference whatsoever. We're just making things up about the past. There'd be no difference between the New York Times and the National Enquirer. Are we really prepared to say that, that we can't know historical events, that it's really just your view and my view? Historical statements would become absurd. Well, let's look at a second objection under this category of historical truth. Aren't historians biased? You know, when historians recorded their history, and when historians today go through those documents and try and flesh out what historical events occurred, aren't they biased? You know, when these historians are writing these things out, didn't they put a spin on it in their own way? Doesn't that mean that we can't really know what happened? We're just getting someone's account, someone's biased account of the events in question? Well, the first thing we can point out in response to this objection is that if this is true, then this bias would contaminate all knowledge, not just historical knowledge. Again, this would infiltrate all different aspects of knowledge. Ask yourself a question. When you go in to visit a doctor and she cures your sickness, wasn't she biased in trying to find the right cure? Well, of course she was biased. That's why she went into medicine, because she wants to figure out how to help sick people. Well, did her bias invalidate her ability to come up with the right cure for your problem? No, actually her bias helped you come up with the right cure for your sickness. Even New Testament critic Bart Ehrman slams on this view in this way. He writes in his book, Did Jesus Exist? He's a critic, not a believer in the Bible, atheist. He says, we take the New Testament's biases into consideration and sometimes take their descriptions of events with a pound of salt, but we do not refuse to use them as historical sources. You see that? We take the New Testament authors. You know, I don't believe Paul was inspired. I don't believe Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John were inspired. But what I do is I read them as historical documents and I take their biases into consideration. That's what he's saying. Well, he goes on. To refuse to use them as sources is to sacrifice the most important avenues to the past that we have on purely ideological, not historical grounds. Do you see his point? He's saying if you are going to dismiss the New Testament documents because they're hopelessly biased, that's not a historical problem. That's an ideological problem. You're doing that because you have a certain worldview, and that's giving you a bias to rejecting the New Testament as historical documents. If we just read them as just uninspired documents of history that were handed down out of the first century, he says we can get certain historical facts from them. Secondly, a bias isn't always bad, as we've pointed out. Sometimes a bias can actually preserve history rather than pervert it. You know, in Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, he explains that he has a filthy bias in describing the life of Jesus. And he says the bias was, I want to get all the facts straight for a watching world. He says, I've investigated this and looked at all the eyewitness reports. So his bias actually helped him preserve history. You know, imagine if you were listening to a hate crime victim come up and give a talk at a public high school. And they tell the story about how they were beaten up by a gang of racist cops. And he says, this is my story about how racism can be so horrible and horrid. Now imagine if someone stood up and said, wait a minute, don't you have like an agenda here? Aren't you trying to push our nation, our culture against racism? Wouldn't that mean that you're biased and we really shouldn't take into consideration your story and what really happened because you have a bias? Well, just because the hate crime victim is biased, that doesn't mean that he's not telling the truth. It actually would help him preserve the truth in a more honest way. Thirdly, we can recognize truth amidst a bias. We can recognize truth amidst a bias. You know, when historians pick up ancient documents, whether they're looking at the New Testament documents or Josephus or Suetonius or Tacitus or whomever, when they pick them up, they can see that there's a bias in the text. But that doesn't make them throw out all of this stuff as hopelessly contaminated. Here's Josephus from the Jewish War. He writes this, quote, in my reflections on the events, I cannot conceal my private sentiments. My country owed its ruin to civil strife. Good Lord, Josephus was biased when he wrote about the Jewish war and the destruction of the temple. Does that mean that we should take Josephus's documents and have a public book burning and say, well, he was biased about recording these details, so we should just throw them all out? Well, of course not. Of course, we can see that he had a reason for writing, but that should not invalidate what he wrote. Well, I would just like to close on this section with this point, okay? If you don't believe in historical study, then no amount of historical evidence will impress you for the New Testament. So if you don't think history is knowable, if you don't think we can know historical facts, nothing I say for the rest of the night will have any impact on you whatsoever. If you don't think we can know history, none of this will help you at all. You know, back in January of 1994, a Gallup poll surveyed Americans, asking them if they believed it was possible that the Holocaust never occurred. You know, the Holocaust that just happened 50 years prior to this. People were still living, walking around who had been there. There was video footage of the Holocaust. January of 1994, they asked Americans if it was possible. One out of three said it was possible. Holocaust never happened. A big hoax. You know what? If that's your view, if you don't think we can know history, I guess no amount of evidence will be able to persuade you, as sad as that is. Well, let's move on to our second T. That's historical truth. The second T is time frame. How early were the New Testament documents written? You know, the events happened in AD 33, leading up to Jesus' crucifixion. But how early of a time span was it, a time frame, before these events happened in AD 33 and the New Testament authors wrote these things down? How long of a time span was it? Well, before we look at the time frame, what I'd like to do is compare the time frame in the New Testament documents with other documents from antiquity, other ancient documents. Okay, let's look at Emperor Tiberius. Here's a bust of Emperor Tiberius. He was the Roman emperor during Jesus' day. He died in AD 37, just 4 years after Christ. The earliest biographies for Tiberius are from AD 110 to 120. They're written by Tacitus and Suetonius. So let's just round up. AD 40 to AD 120, we're looking at a gap of about 80 years. After Tiberius died and the first historians began to write and describe the life of Emperor Tiberius. Well, what about Alexander the Great? Alexander the Great died in 323 BC. Do you know when the earliest known biography of Alexander the Great was written? It was written in AD 130 by Arrian. Supposedly, Herodotus and other authors at the time documented events about Alexander, but they're non-existent. We don't have them. The earliest known biography of Alexander the Great is from AD 130. That's a 450-year gap between when he died and when his biography was written. Now let's compare that with Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth died in AD 33, and yet he has four biographies written about his life, all written within the first century, all written within a generation of his death. Let's just say two generations of his death, just to appeal to the critics. He had four biographies. Now, this is pretty embarrassing if you're Emperor Tiberius and Alexander the Great. Here, you're an ancient king, emperor, conqueror of the known world, and you've got one or two biographies written within 80 years or 400 years of your life. Here's a carpenter from Palestine, never traveled 100 miles from the place he was born, and he has four biographies written about his life. What other king, emperor, teacher, philosopher, general, warrior has four biographies written about him, all within a generation of his death. Now, I'd like to ask you a few questions here. Do historians believe that Alexander and Tiberius existed? Do they believe that the general details about their lives are accurate from these biographies? Do they trust the general historical outline that we have in these accounts? Well, of course they do. They don't think that these are absolutely perfect, but they're able to explain the lives of these men from these biographies that have been written down. Well, that being said, now that we know the comparison in time frame between the New Testament documents and other ancient figures of influence, let's look at some of the reasons why we should date the New Testament documents in the first century, that they were written in the first century, not the second or third century, as we've argued. Well, the first line of evidence is found in the John Rylands fragment. Old critics used to argue that the New Testament was written in the second century. The Gospel of John, oh boy, that could have been incredibly late. Maybe the third century. Of course, it wasn't written by an eyewitness like it claims to have been. It was probably written by one of John's long-lost disciples, maybe as far away as Greece, the Gospel of John, because it has Greek overtones in his biography of Jesus' life. Critics used to argue, and Christian scholars argue the same thing, that you have the Gospel of Mark written first. That's the earliest of the four Gospels. They call this Markan priority. Mark was written first. Then Matthew and Luke use Mark as a common source for when they wrote their Gospels. 90% of what's in Mark is in Matthew or Luke combined. But then the Gospel of John, oh man, that was written way after the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So John was written way late, probably in the 3rd century AD. Well, this view was put down back in the 1920s when the John Rylands fragment was found. It was found in Egypt, and it's a fragment. It's very small. It's a fragment of John chapter 18, a few verses out of John 18. It was found in a coffin in Egypt, and it's dated to right around 120 AD. That means that this document must have been written and traveled to Egypt in that amount of time. Some people believe that this fragment is actually a copy of John's original penmanship, his original autograph. So, wait a minute. If this is dated, this copy is dated to 120 AD, and it made it all the way to Egypt by that time, well, that must mean that the Gospel of John was written before then. Let's just be conservative. Let's say 100 AD. But if John was written in 100 AD, and for years everyone has always agreed that Mark, Matthew, and Luke were written before John, then that must mean that all four Gospels must be dated before the time of the second century, contrary to the critical school of thought. Secondly, the book of Acts can be dated accurately before 62 AD. Now, how do you know that? How do you know that the book of Acts was written before 62 AD? Well, for those of you who don't know what the book of Acts is, this is the history of the early church that's found in the Bible. It goes Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, the Acts of the Apostles. It's Luke's second book. He wrote the Gospel of Luke, and then he went on to write the book of Acts just to document how the early church spread. Okay, so it must have been written after the Gospel of Luke. In the very beginning of Acts, Luke says, in my prior account about the life of Jesus, he's referring to the Gospel of Luke. Well, how do we know that the book of Acts was written in 62 AD? Let me give you a few reasons. The book of Acts doesn't mention the death of Paul. It follows Paul from Acts 13. Paul is on house arrest by the end of Acts 28. Now, history tells us that Paul died sometime under the reign of Emperor Nero, which ends in 67 AD. So if Paul died before 67 AD, why wouldn't Luke mention it? Paul is the star of the book of Acts on the second half of that book. If Paul had already died, why does Luke leave the story off on a cliffhanger where he's staying under Roman house arrest? Secondly, the book of Acts doesn't mention Peter's death. Peter died under Emperor Nero as well before 67 AD. Why doesn't it mention Peter's death? Thirdly, why doesn't Luke mention James's death? James, the brother of Jesus, who in Acts 21 is the center of the early church. You know, Eusebius mentions James's death. Josephus, the non-Christian historian, mentions James's death in his Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 20. Why doesn't Luke mention James's death? Well, James must have died sometime before 62 AD. If he had died already, why wouldn't he have mentioned him in the book of Acts? Fourthly, Luke doesn't mention the Jewish war. Josephus records that 1.1 million Jews died in the Jewish war. This was catastrophic to Jerusalem. Could you imagine 1.1 million people being killed by sword? The blood was flowing in Jerusalem. Luke never mentions it. He mentions other persecutions. He mentions how the government and different people were persecuting Christians, never mentions the Jewish war. Then in AD 70, the Romans came in and not only destroyed Jerusalem, they destroyed the temple. Luke never mentions it. He mentions every other detail in the book of Acts, never mentions those five things. So he doesn't mention the death of Paul, the death of Peter, the death of James, the Jewish war, or the destruction of the temple. This would be like a reporter on assignment in Paris, France in 1942 and not mentioning Nazi Germany occupying France. Okay, it's an argument from silence, but it's a conspicuous silence. We would expect Christian author recording these events. A third reason for dating the New Testament early is found in 1 Corinthians 15. Well, what is this? Are we using the Bible to prove the Bible? 1 Corinthians 15, we're going to use that as a historical source. Yeah, actually, this is our closest historical source to the life of Christ. Let me read this passage. You've probably read this before, didn't understand the historical importance of this passage. 1 Corinthians is accurately dated by critics, non-Christians, to right around 51-52 AD. They don't challenge that Paul wrote the book, and they believe that it was written in 50 AD. This is what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15. Verse 3, "For I delivered to you, Corinthians, as of first importance what I also received." Now, secular historians will look at that phrase there. "I delivered unto you that which I also received." That expression in Greek was used by Pharisees to describe how they would pass on sacred teaching from a rabbi. Paul was a Pharisee. Paul's using the exact same formal language to describe how someone passed on to him knowledge of Christ that he is going to pass on to you. And from that second half of the verse all the way down, non-Christian scholars believe that this was an early Christian teaching that was either verbally transmitted or written out, we don't know, that must have preceded Paul. Somebody gave this to Paul, probably on his journey in Galatians 1, where it says 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem and met with Peter and James. What do you think they were talking about? Paul was going through getting the historical details about Christ's life. Well, what do we read? What is he quoting? He says, "I delivered to you that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Cephas meaning Peter. Now they notice here, we've got parallelism. That Christ died, that he was buried, that he was raised, that he appeared. It's kind of like the Declaration of Independence. It has the same kind of parallelism. We believe that all men were created equal, that they are endowed with unalienable rights. That it's the same kind of parallelism. It's in a structured form. The same verse comes up according to the scriptures, according to the scriptures. Paul never uses that exact phrase in Greek. This must have been from somebody other than Paul. It's in a stanza. It's in a formalized statement of faith that was passed down to him. Well, how do we know how early this thing is? Well, it must be earlier than 50. How early does it go back? Let me tell you that the Jesus Seminar, which is the most critical school of scholarship on earth today, places this no later than 3 years after the life of Christ. They dated it 36 A.D. Here's Gerd Ludemann, atheistic New Testament critic, debates how Jesus never rose from the dead, not a believer. He writes this in his book, What Really Happened to Jesus? He thinks the whole thing was a vision, hallucination. He writes this on page 9, quote, the testimony of Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 is the earliest text in the New Testament to make concrete mention of the death, resurrection, and appearances of the risen Christ. So this mentions all of the core details about Jesus' life. He goes on, here Paul uses traditions which he knows from an earlier period. He's using it from people that passed it on to him. As 1 Corinthians is usually dated around 50 A.D., we may note first that the traditions which he mentions must be even older. Then on page 15, he writes, it is hard to say what the relationship is between the event itself, this resurrection event, and the development and description of it. Because of the extraordinary nature of the event in question, we may suppose that it was also reported immediately after the appearance of Jesus. He says, this section from 1 Corinthians 15, could it have come up years down the line? He says, no, I think this was written immediately, days or weeks after Jesus supposedly rose from the dead. He doesn't believe that actually happened. He writes, how could it be conceivable that an event took place and was only related, shall we say, 10 years later? He says the idea that this section of 1 Corinthians 15 was written a decade later, he says that's inconceivable, to use his words. This was immediately created by the early Christian community, and Paul quotes it at least by 50 A.D. Did this idea that Jesus rose from the dead kind of propagate in the second century or decades later? No. It goes right back to the events in question. We can also point out that the book of Hebrews must have been written before 70 A.D. as well. Why do we know that the book of Hebrews was written before 70 A.D.? Well, the book of Hebrews is a letter to the Jewish believers in the ancient times, telling them to stop going to the temple and offering sacrifices to God because Jesus already paid the sacrifice on the cross. The whole book is how Jesus has already paid for sin. You don't need to go back and do animal sacrifices. Here's a question. If the temple was destroyed, why would the author of Hebrews have to write the letter? He's writing it as though they're on the way to the temple, and they're about to sacrifice animals. Why write the letter if the temple has been torn down by the Romans? Well, what does the book of Hebrews tell us about Christ? Hebrews chapter 1. He was greater than angels. He's considered Yahweh God. Chapter 2. He was fully human. Chapter 3. He was greater than Joshua and Moses. He's greater than the Levitical priesthood. Here in the book of Hebrews, we have a fully supernatural, fully divine, fully man, death and resurrecting Jesus before 70 AD. It's at least a historical document that shows us that. Then we have the letters of Paul. We have the letters of Paul that can be dated sometime between 48 and 67 AD. Let's think. How does Paul refer to Jesus? Well, he mentions in 1 Timothy 6 that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He says that Jesus was fully God, that Jesus performed miracles, that Jesus died on the cross, that Jesus rose from the dead. In Paul's letters, we have a fully divine, fully human, death and resurrecting Jesus, dated within a couple decades after Christ's death. Now, we're not saying that those are inspired letters. We're just saying they're historical documents that can date sometime between that time. And then finally, we have evidence from the early church fathers. The early church fathers weren't the apostles. They weren't Jesus' disciples. They were kind of like the disciples of the disciples. They were the next generation of the Christian church in the second century. Well, how would these guys help us date the New Testament early? How would that be able to help us? Well, three of the earliest church fathers, Clement of Rome, AD 96, Ignatius, AD 108, and Polycarp, AD 110. These are the three earliest guys. They wrote sometime between 96 and 110. That's the end of the first century, beginning of the second. They quote 25 of the 27 New Testament books. It's almost as though the New Testament was fully written in the first century, and they're already quoting from it. Because of this evidence, critic John Robinson, who was trained under the Tübingen School, highly critical German scholarship from the 19th century and into the 20th. John Robinson believed that John was written in the 3rd century, that most of the letters were written late 2nd century. Because of this evidence that has been discovered in the last century, Robinson wrote a book called Redating the New Testament, a critical scholar, where he said that the entire New Testament could be dated before 70 AD. We think John was written probably in 80 or 90 even, and Revelation, the same thing. This is what Robinson writes. It was at this point that I began to ask myself just why any of these books in the New Testament needed to be put after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. As one began to look at them, and in particular the epistle to the Hebrews, which we mentioned, Acts, and the Apocalypse, which is the book of Revelation, was it not strange that the destruction of the temple was never once mentioned or apparently hinted at? So, as little more than a theological joke, I thought I would see how far one could get with the hypothesis that the whole New Testament was written before 70 AD. But what began as a joke became, in the process, a serious preoccupation, and I convinced myself that the hypothesis must be tested in greater detail. Well, if you go on to read his book, you find that he dates the entire New Testament before 70. Let's move on to number three, transmission. How have these documents been transmitted to us? Okay, so the New Testament documents were written early. They're written in the first century. There's not too much debate over that. Even the highly critical scholars will say, well, they were written in the first century. Yeah, but how do we know that we're reading in our modern Bible what they wrote in the first century? You know, we don't have any manuscripts that have the Apostle Paul's fingerprints on them. You know, we don't have any documents that were handled by John or Luke. Those have all faded into the ashes of history. So how do we know that what they actually wrote is what we are actually reading? Well, let's consider the words of Bart Ehrman. Ehrman, in his book, Misquoting Jesus, on page 10, writes this. Not only do we not have the originals, we don't have the first copies of the originals. We don't even have the copies of the originals, or the copies of the copies of the copies of the originals. That's how far distant we are from what they actually wrote. He writes, what we have are copies made later, much later. In most instances, they are copies made many centuries later. And these copies all differ from one another in many thousands of places. So he's a critic, not a believer in the Bible. He says we have all these different copies of the New Testament, and they differ from one another in thousands of places. He calculates in his book, if you read the book, about 400,000 variations between what we have in the New Testament. I've never heard that number substantiated anywhere else, but that's his claim. And he's a textual critic. So do we really even know what they wrote if there's that many variations in the text? Well, he writes, these copies differ from one another in so many places, we don't even know how many differences there are. You know, when you pick up your Bible, your New Testament, they're getting those English words from the original Greek manuscripts, but there's so many differences. We don't even know how many differences there are. How do we even know what they wrote? Well, these claims are misleading for a number of reasons. Let me give you a few reasons why they're misleading. Variations in manuscripts are not the same as contradictions in manuscripts. So let's say we have 15 different copies of the book of Romans, and we're matching them all up together, and we're trying to figure out what the original said because we have so many different copies. Well, when we compare them, just because there are variants between the copies, that doesn't mean that they're contradicting each other. Bach and Wallace, in their book Dethroning Jesus, state that in Greek, Koine Greek, the language in which the New Testament was written, there are 16 different ways to say Jesus loves John. 16 different ways to say that very simple sentence. You've got a subject, a verb, and a direct object. That's it. There's 16 different ways to say that. Now imagine if you came home and your wife came up to you and said, I love you. And then she said, you are loved by me. And then she said, I adore you, baby. And then she said, I really care about you a lot. Would you say, quit contradicting yourself? In these documents, what we have are these variants, but they're not contradictions. The text is resolute in its message. These are variants in word order, which doesn't matter, spelling differences, which doesn't matter, and other minor variations. Even Ehrman himself, at the end of his book, page 207, admits this point. Ehrman writes this, to be sure, of all the hundreds of thousands of textual changes found among our manuscripts, most of them are completely insignificant, immaterial, and of no real importance for anything. Boy, I'm sure glad that we made it to the end of the book where he admitted that. Okay, of no real importance for anything other than showing that scribes could not spell or keep focused any better than the rest of us. How misleading. How misleading could you get? Now, he's writing popular books. He's a scholar from North Carolina, and regular people are reading his books, and if they don't get to the end of the book, they would never see this crucial caveat. Here's Bach and Wallace. These are believing scholars. This is from their book, Dethroning Jesus. They write this. We noted the kinds of errors that are to be found in the copies. These guys have actually looked at the copies also, okay? The vast majority of them are quite inconsequential. And less than 1% of all textual variants both affect the meaning of that verse, though none affects core doctrine and have some plausibility of authenticity. There are about 138,000 Greek words in the New Testament. 1,400 of them are disputed. 1,400 of them are disputed. And yet, of those 1,400 words, nothing theological, nothing important hinges or hangs on those 1,400 words. 1% of the New Testament, it has a variant in it, but nothing core hangs on that. A big chunk of that is the end of the Gospel of Mark, Mark 16, 9-20, which conservative scholars don't believe was in the original. We throw that out. Then you've got John 7:53 to 8:10, somewhere in there. And that's another story that is disputed. And beyond that, you have words here and there, which if you read through your Bible, the Bible translators will write that down and notate where there are variants. So it's 99% accurate to what they wrote originally. Here's the way Norman Geisler explains it. This is a pretty good illustration. He says, imagine if you got this message in the mail. You have won the $5 million Reader's Digest sweepstakes. Well, how do we really know what this is saying? I mean, it's got the Y, the first letter is marked out. How do we know it's not saying Lou have won the $5 million sweepstakes? Well, that would be Lou has won. Well, I don't know. Being the skeptic that you are, you rip it up and you throw it out. Okay. But then a week later, you get another message in the mail and it says this. You have won the $5 million sweepstakes. Only the W on one is marked out. Well, how difficult would it be to reconstruct what the original message is? You place this one on top of the other one, and with a high degree of certainty, you could figure out, you could cash in on the message that's being described here. Well, in the same way, while this is a simplification, we can still cash in on the message of Christ by what's written in the New Testament, even though there are a few variants. Nothing theological is being attacked. Nothing core is being attacked by these different variants. Well, let's compare the New Testament transmission to other ancient documents. Let's start with Tacitus. Tacitus's Annals, written in right around AD 100, just to give a round number. Tacitus wrote in 100. Our earliest copy of Tacitus is 1,000 years later. Do you see that? He wrote in 100. The earliest known copy is from 1100 AD. That's a time gap of 1,000 years. But we do have 20 copies of Tacitus. So if there were any variants in the Tacitus documents, we could compare and contrast those and figure out what Tacitus wrote. Okay. Well, let's compare that with Thucydides. Thucydides wrote his history in 400 BC, roughly. Our earliest copy of Thucydides was written in 900 AD. That's a 1,300-year time gap. A time gap of 1,300 years from when it was written to our earliest copies. And how many copies of Thucydides do we have? Well, we've got 8 copies. Okay. We've got 8 copies, and do historians believe Thucydides is reliable, even though we only have 8 copies? Yeah, I think he's reliable. What about Herodotus' history? He wrote in 425 BC, earliest copy, 900 AD, a time gap of 1,300 years from when he wrote to our earliest document. We've only got 8 copies of Herodotus. Well, what about Demosthenes, 300 BC? Earliest copy, 1100 AD, time gap of 1,400 years. Whoa, 200 copies. Jackpot. We've got tons of copies of Demosthenes. That must be a pretty good historical source. Pretty good. Better than Herodotus. Better than Thucydides. What about Homer's Iliad? Wrote in 800 BC. Our earliest known copy is 400 BC. That's only a time gap of 400 years. Way better than the other ones. 643 copies of Homer's Iliad. That is pretty good. I mean, that is an excellent amount of copies. Just think about how many copies that is. 600 copies, you get to compare and contrast them with one another. You could, with a high degree of certainty, they say about 95% accuracy, reconstruct the original. Well, let's compare these other documents from antiquity with the New Testament documents. The New Testament was written, let's say, sometime in the second half of the first century. Our earliest fragment dates to AD 117. That's a time gap of only about a decade. Our earliest books, complete books of the New Testament, date to 200 AD. That's a time gap of 100 years, way less than any other document we have from ancient times. Most of the New Testament is dated to 250 AD. There's different papyri that have the entire New Testament by that time, most of it. And how many documents do we have before the fall of Rome? How many documents in the New Testament do we have? 5,366. Remember Homer's Iliad was 643? That's second best to the New Testament. The New Testament has more manuscript documentation than any other document from antiquity. By a lot, not by a little bit, by a lot. When you add in, these are just the Greek copies, the language in which it was written. When you add in the Coptic, the Latin, the other different translations that were made, you get a grand total of 25,000 copies of the New Testament before the fall of Rome. So those translations aren't the original, but they help you understand what would have been written in the original if they were being translated at that time. We've got more manuscript evidence than any other ancient document. Now, what's peculiar to me is I've read Ehrman. Ehrman's a critical scholar. He says he went off to Princeton to study under his mentor, Bruce Metzger. Okay. And he said when he started to look into the manuscript evidence for the New Testament, he just thought there's so many variations. This actually led him to lose his faith in Christ. That's Ehrman's story. However, what's odd is his mentor, the guy he looked up to, Bruce Metzger, says that when he studied the same evidence, this caused him to strengthen his faith. So which is it? Is this evidence good evidence or is it bad? Well, Metzger writes this. He's dead now, but he was from Princeton University. He says, quote, textual criticism has increased the basis of my personal faith to see the firmness with which these materials have come down to us with a multiplicity of copies, some of which are very, very ancient. I've dug into the text. I've studied this thoroughly. And today I know with confidence that my trust in Jesus has been well placed. Very well placed. That's why I'm so suspicious of Ehrman, because how can he look at this same evidence and say, oh, that made me lose my faith? When his mentor, the guy he looked up to, who's far more knowledgeable than him, says, actually, this made me strengthen my faith as I got into scholarship. Well, let's consider a common objection that's kind of under the umbrella of this subject of historical transmission. Wasn't the New Testament passed along like a game of telephone? You remember being a little kid where they'd whisper the message into the kid's ear next to them, and then they'd whisper it to the next person. And, you know, you'd start off with a message like games are played in this space, and it would end with James has an ugly face. At least that's how I remember it from grade school. I know. Pity party for me. I'll get over it. Don't worry. Wasn't the New Testament played like this? Wasn't it just one person transmitted it to the next person and then they transmitted it? And there's so much room for error that by the time we got it, it was just completely contorted and distorted. Well, let me give you a few reasons why this is just not at all the way the New Testament was transmitted. First, when you play the game of telephone, you try to make the phrase unintelligible. That's part of the game. That's part of the fun. You try and pick an expression that is unintelligible, that you can't understand. The New Testament was in no way transmitted like this. Secondly, when you play the game of telephone, you whisper the message only once to the person sitting next to you. Do you remember being in class? You'd say, tell me again. They'd be like, no, shut up. Tell the next person. You only get one try. You whispered the message once. The New Testament wasn't whispered, it was written. It was not given to one person, it was given to several thousand. And translators don't translate from the latest copies, they go back to the earliest copies. This would be like if you made it down the line in telephone and then you said, wait a minute, let's start at the beginning. What was the message? You go back to the earliest written copies, not the latest. Before I got into Christianity, also, I just assumed that the New Testament was written in one language that was translated into a second language and translated into a third, which was translated into a fourth, which was translated into English. That's not at all how the New Testament was translated. It was translated exactly one time from the original Greek documents till today. So it's really a bad illustration. Let's give a third reason, though. When you play the game of telephone, the message isn't life-changing. Imagine how different it would be if the message was, there's a bomb in the room, get out. I bet people could remember the message a little bit better then, don't you think? The message of the New Testament is life-changing. They had reason to preserve this accurately. Well, let me just pause there for questions before we move on. I can only take a few questions because we packed it tight with information. Who's got a thought to raise? Yeah, that's right. I fully agree. So he pointed out that Luke recorded Stephen's death in Acts chapter 7. He's not bashful at talking about blood and death. He mentions that Stephen died. He mentions that James of Zebedee died in Acts 12:2. But he doesn't mention James, the brother of Jesus, Paul, or Peter. Wouldn't you expect him to write it? And you know, Paul is even talking about how he thinks he's going to die in Rome in the book of Acts, and yet it's just a complete drop-off, a cliffhanger. It's never mentioned. I fully agree. That's why guys like Robinson were so persuaded that this must have been written earlier. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, that doesn't show that Paul's letters were written early. But what it shows is that the concrete core facts about Jesus' life were recorded early. So Paul records that he was killed, he was buried, he rose, and he appeared. So those four facts were mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15. Paul merely cites that and records it and puts that into his 15th chapter. Now, as far as dating Paul's letters, there's a lot of difficulty in doing that if we're trying to argue that all 13 letters were written by Paul. Scholarship is not agreed on that. Now, obviously, as believers in the Bible, we would believe that Paul wrote every letter that he claimed to have written, and there's good evidence for that, too. But without having to go down that rabbit trail, which is argued by scholarship, we could say that at least four of Paul's letters were written by him: Galatians, Romans, and 1st and 2nd Corinthians. I can't think of someone who would deny those four letters being written by Paul. Even the Tubingen school from the 19th century, that German school, they believe those were written by Paul. And they all date. Galatians is dated to 49 AD, 1st and 2nd Corinthians to 52, and Romans to the winter of 56, 57. So you've got Paul mentioning who Christ was, everything about him, in at least those four letters, whether or not you believe he wrote all 13. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the question is, what about this Q source that's often brought up? Even believing scholars believe in the Q source. The Q source is a non-existent document. We don't have any manuscript evidence for it. We don't have a document with all these sayings or life of Jesus on it. However, when we compare Matthew and Luke with one another, I said that 90% of what's in Mark is in Matthew or Luke. But there's a percentage of words that are shared by Matthew and Luke which are not found in Mark. That could either mean that they were talking to each other or they had a second common source, which guys like Carson and other people believe was the Q or Quell source, which was just a written statement of maybe the core facts of Jesus' life. In Acts 20:35, Paul quotes words from Jesus. He says, even Jesus said, it is better to give than to receive. When we flip through the four Gospels, do you know where we find that statement? Nowhere. He's not drawing that from the four Gospels. He must have a written source of Jesus' statements that are not in our Bible. And he's quoting from that. And then, of course, we have in 1 Corinthians 11, where he's talking about the Last Supper. It's almost word for word from Luke, but it's just different enough that people think that there might be another source that he's drawing from. If it is, it was just a historical document that was written that hasn't made its way down to us. But that's about all it is. It's not like it's a different gospel or a different message. It's purely a hypothesized source that we don't have that could have existed. I guess I just leave it in that regard. It might have existed. It might not have existed. I'm comfortable with that.